This was the age of mesmerism and seances. And in that age, Jefferson stands out as a strict scientific rationalist, a believer that nature withholds all the truth we are capable of understanding, and is the source not only of truth and value, but of beauty. All right. Jefferson, in fact, always carried with him, or rather, wherever he lived, hung up a series of portraits, his trinity of the three greatest men who ever lived. These were Bacon, Newton, and Locke, the three champions of the English Enlightenment. Jefferson sees them all as materialists. He writes to John Adams, "I feel bodies which are not myself. There are other existences then. I call them matter. I feel them changing place. This gives me motion. Where there is an absence of matter, I call it void or nothing or immaterial space. On the basis of sensation or matter in motion, we may erect the fabric of all the certainties we can have or need." Now, this is standard materialism, but it has a hard edge to it. He writes, "To talk of immaterial existences is to talk of nothings. To say that the human soul, angels, God, are immaterial is to say they are nothings, or that there is no God, no angels, no soul." Well, in fact, Jefferson's materialism is thoroughly reductionistic. Now, reductionism and materialism means that you're going to eliminate everything which doesn't appear to be material. And the most pointed example in that time and our own is the human mind, which Descartes described as an unextended substance. Well, Jefferson reads Locke's sensational psychology as giving credence or support to a mechanistic or pneumatic model of mind, which is to say, Jefferson is like certain contemporary philosophers, Michael Dennett, in arguing that, in fact, there is no mind, there's just a brain. He writes to Adams again in 1820, "Why may not the mode of action called thought have been given to a material organ of peculiar structure, as that of magnetism is to the needle, or of elasticity to the spring by a particular manipulation of the steel?" And this is a very deep point Jefferson's raising. At the time, without our current electron theory, we didn't know what, or people at the time did not know what caused magnetism, nor did they know what caused the elasticity of a spring. But they were confident that there was some mechanical explanation of it. And Jefferson is equally confident that there will be some mechanical explanation of the mind. He doesn't go as far as certain French philosophers to say that the brain secretes thought like the liver secretes bile. But he's certain that at some point in the future, neurology will answer this question. Indeed, he invokes as the clincher in arguing against the existence of mind, Occam's razor. And Occam's razor is a principle that states when you can explain a phenomena with one posited entity as opposed to two, or one explanation as opposed to two, it's always superior. Simplicity wins. Well, again, he writes to Adams in this remarkable letter, "It requires one effort only to admit the single incomprehensibility of matter endowed with thought, and two, to believe, first, that of an existence called spirit, of which we have neither evidence nor idea, and then secondly, how that spirit, which has neither extension nor solidity, can put material organs into motion." And Jefferson has seized on the fundamental problem of dualism, the problem of interaction. Okay. Well, those are Jefferson's metaphysical views, and they're of a decidedly radical nature. What unites them is a devotion to the notion that nature is the source of all of our knowledge. And we'll see Jefferson's ethical views are very similar. Again, he's a naturalist. He believes that reason can examine nature and experience and from it draw out ethical values and norms. Now, there's two elements of Jefferson's ethical thought we're going to look at. First, his ethos, which is to say, what is his theory of the good? What is his summum bonum? And at several points, he describes himself as an Epicurean. The ethical goal of Epicureanism is a life of pleasure and happiness removed from the tumults and cares of the external world. Now, I want to be clear. Epicureanism is not the same thing as hedonism. It's not about physical pleasures, because those are always mixed with pains. It's about intellectual pleasures and the spiritual pleasures of friendship. As he writes to Adams again, "The summum bonum with me is now truly Epicurean, ease of body and tranquility of mind, and to these I wish to consign my remaining days." And Jefferson's quite explicit in explaining what his particular Epicurean pleasures are, at least in old age, and those are the joys of reading classical literature. "When the decays of age have enfeebled the useful energies of the mind, the classic pages fill up the cave of ennui." Now, Jefferson's Epicureanism was also tinged with a very heavy dose of Stoicism. These are both classical traditions from the Roman world. Stoicism stresses two things. One, emotional reserve, keeping oneself under the keeping one's feelings under wraps.